Friday, another Friday, and this is the 66th edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. Those of you who watched or listened know the drill very well. I'm John Zogby. I'm with my son, Jeremy. We are pollsters, market researchers, father, son, and colleagues. And what we're trying to do is something different. We take a topic or two each week and discuss it, often from very different points of view, but always respectfully and gently. And that's what we're going to do again today. How are you doing this week, Jer?
Doing great. And I would just add in there, analysts, historians, and then once in a while, maybe a little bit of a poet, right? Poets.
They're here and there. Absolutely. So we're jumping in, right? Today happens to be the 101st day of the Biden administration. And so obviously, we're going to talk about the first 100 days with President Biden. And as usual, I kick it off. So where do we stand? Well, more importantly, where does he stand? His average job approval rating is at 53. The cluster of more recent polls have him at about 54. That's a good rating anyway. That's an even greater rating when you consider that, number one, he was elected with only 51% of the vote. And so he's managed to build his numbers, his approval up by 3 or 4 percentage points. In addition to that, it's very good in our hyper-polarized world that, he's not evenly split. His approval rating is solid. His disapproval rating is only at about 40 or 41%. Frankly, presidents haven't been getting those kinds of numbers of late. For historical purposes, Dwight Eisenhower's numbers were not this good at 100 days. John Kennedy's weren't either. Only Lyndon Johnson, after the assassination, was better. Bill Clinton's were not this good, nor were Ronald Reagan's, certainly Barack Obama's, George W. Bush, and Donald Trump. So where does the president stand? He has a record of accomplishments in the first 100 days, a $1.9 trillion spending program, widely popular, passed a narrow margin in the Congress. And now he gave his maiden speech before both houses of Congress in a very strange COVID era setting. But I think what he laid out for himself was not a presidency that was going to be transitional, but one that he believes and hopes to be transformational, that he sees himself in the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt, who responded to a serious crisis by moving the federal government more and more into the economy and our lives. Like Lyndon Johnson, who responded to serious race riots and a coming apart culturally in the United States and launched a great society. And now Joe Biden attacking problems that face the middle class, not just simply the poor, but those who've been dislocated by the economy, those who've been dislocated by COVID, and those who've been dislocated also by the growing inequality of income in the United States. So this is an aggressive speech. It is a transformational speech, and it is someone who is clearly aiming to be one of the great presidents of the United States, certainly in the view of historians. What do you think?
Well, that was a glaring review of the president in the first 101 days.
So should we stop now?
I'm sorry?
So should we stop this now then?
Yeah. Yeah. No. I think, what you said 54% approval. Which poll was that?
That's the RCP.
Average?
Average, yeah. Okay. And it includes most recent number yesterday, by Rasmussen was at 48. So the cluster of polls are aside from Rasmussen are a little higher, but let's keep it at 53, 54.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a clear majority. You know, I mean, regardless of who the president is, I think it's in the best interest to look at the critical view. You know, I think to me, it's become obvious that the national media can make or break a personality. Trump, no doubt about it, was abrasive, was in your face, and he clearly threatened the establishment. And I think as a result, the national media had it out for him. I do believe, though, that had the national media wanted to portray him in a better light, they could. The national media now under the presidency of Biden, I think, does everything it can to portray Biden in a positive light. In other words, the national media can make or break a person. I think they have that awesome power. That's very troubling to me. So to me, as a citizen, the job is to criticize, not just to be, you know, an annoying pest, but to go beyond cheerleading, to go beyond, oh, they did this great, and they did that great, and they did this great, to always put it in the context of a positive light, or if they hate the person, always putting it in a context of negativity. In other words, to be objective. I mean, I just say, look at the last 100 years. This is stepping aside. At what point in a decade were we not in a crisis? I understand the Great Depression and this are, you know, and 9/11 are extraordinary, but the justification of a crisis has always been used to push forth an agenda. And I think that's part of the growing trend of, we've talked about the imperial presidency. I think it's kind of bordering on the cult of the presidency. And I ask the question, at what point does one begin to say there's too much intrusion, whether it's a Democrat or whether it's a Republican? I know Democrats tend to believe when a Republican is in the presidency, there's too much intrusion, vice versa, when Republicans have a Democrat, there's too much intrusion. But objectively speaking, as a citizen, looking at the last 100 years, at what point, and I'm going to direct this to you, I'm directing it to our audience, but for you, where would you draw the line with this president and say, okay, in what scenario would you say we're going too far, we are actually entering the Leviathan state?
All right, so let me address a few things, and of course I'm going to answer your questions to the best of my ability. The first is, this has been a honeymoon for Joe Biden, and frankly, every other president in my memory and my historical knowledge has gotten a honeymoon in their first 100 days, certainly since Franklin Roosevelt. Every single one, except Donald Trump, and plenty of blame to go on both sides. He declared war on the media during his campaign and during his inaugural address. They responded in kind and maybe even, I would argue, over the top. But the bottom line is they both thrived on that nasty codependent relationship that they had. You know, the broadcast media's numbers went sky high, and Donald Trump got what he got out of the deal. He didn't seek anything but confrontation. He got confrontation. But to say that Joe Biden has been getting love letters, that's really the tradition in the first 100 days, is, you know, give the new president in office that slack, or in Tip O'Neill's famous terms when he was speaker during Ronald Reagan, give Reagan enough rope and he'll hang himself. And of course, he was wrong. So that's number one. Number two, in terms of the intrusion, as you know, and you hinted at it, it's been both Democrat and Republican. Absolutely. You know, for every New Deal, there was a federal highway system. The first Civil Rights Act was passed under Eisenhower. You know, for every great society and a record amount up to that point in domestic spending, there was Ronald Reagan's Star Wars. So when Jimmy Carter left office, the annual budget deficit was at $34 billion. When Ronald Reagan left office, there was a $2 trillion accumulated deficit, and we were doing 200 to 250 million annual deficits. So the point is, and there are, you know, many other historical examples of that, bottom line is federal government marches forward. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? You're going to get your equal time on the bad thing. But I look at history and I say, hey, Roosevelt had to act. He had to do something. That's so obvious to me, you know, there's no sense even explaining it. It was relief. It was recovery. It was reform. Those of us who were there with Lyndon Johnson, something had to be done. This country was coming apart. It was coming apart racially. There were two different Americas, according to the Kerner Report. You know, one white and one black. We were separate and unequal. Something had to be done beyond voting rights and civil rights. Black communities needed institutions and needed leadership development, needed relief. This time around, we have been paying lip service to the inequalities that cover a good portion of the middle class. And so there is in this bill, number one, a long-standing plan for infrastructure, traditional infrastructure renewal and rebuilding. But there's also a plan for college education, for parental leave, bailouts, or not bailouts, but aid to small businesses, to green economy and green technology. There are jobs in this package. There are also efforts to enable American workers to be more productive by not having to worry paycheck to paycheck, you know, by being able to get affordable childcare, being able to send their kids to a public college for 2 years with free tuition. I say, if given the nature of our problems and the threat to our democracy, I mean that very seriously, this is a necessary package. It's not too much.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm reminded of the great investor, Jim Rogers, who's 80 years old, by the way, who says, hey, baby boomers and the silent generation, they got it made because they don't have to deal with the ramifications. Mm-hmm. It's us Gen Xers and millennials and Gen Zers. I mean, the baby boomers, those who are 60 and above, they don't have to worry. You know, they've got less time on this planet than we do. And so whenever the piper has to get paid, don't worry about it, baby boomers. Don't worry about it, silent generation. You know, FDR and the New Deal. I mean, there's substantial evidence. And I think you just look at the fact that the Great Depression went from 1929 until World War II. The war, in other words, ended the depression. So that was a decade-long depression, which in itself can really point to the fact that acting and the intervention that the New Deal did prolong the depression. I've talked about this before. Why was the depression of 1920-21 so short? Because Harding primarily did very little, and the depression worked itself out. The Great Depression lasted over a decade because of continuous intervention, prolonging it, making it worse. You talk about the Great Society, and we've talked before about the African-American community and the African-American family and how strong they had rebuilt themselves over 100 years to get to the level of white America and to have, you know, I'm not saying that they were equal in terms of capital. They weren't, but unemployment was on par. In other words, employment was on par between the average white American, the average black American, and the family structure was on par. What changed all of that? It was precisely the intervention, the policies of the Great Society, which decimated the family and the community. There's no question about that. So we see here that intervention can have unforeseen effects. Public relations does a wonderful job pointing to the immediate relief, but they often always overlook the long-term effects. That's the job of a good economist, to say what could possibly be the unintended consequences. You will never hear that in the public relations delivering of a legislation piece. It's always, we have to do this now, and if we don't, the world is going to end and everything is going to be great. But looking at things in broader perspective, because you were talking about the growth of federal government, M1 is the money supply, the most liquid of money supply. That's cash, coins, checkable deposits, and saving deposits. In other words, it's the money that you can get most quickly and pour into the economy. In January of 2020, M1 was at 4 trillion units, $4 trillion. Today, it's at 18 trillion. So in about a year, a little over a year, a 70% growth of M1, of the expansion of M1. And you're starting to see in surveys that are tracking the public's perception and sentiment of inflation, for the first time that I've been observing this for about a decade, you're starting to see a consensus, an awareness, a change in psychology that there's an expectation that goods, staples in the future, in the near future, are going to be more expensive. And that's because of the growth of the money supply of M1, that move from $4 trillion to $18 trillion. That's data you can find at the St. Louis Fed. Or the BLS, one or the other.
It doesn't have anything to do with the dramatic rise in gas prices, with the pressure that's being put on the supply chain, on the inability to find truck drivers willing to go coast to coast. That is not a factor. It's all in one.
Well, I think supply chain plays a role in it, but the quantitative theory of money posits that, and this, I mean, you know, this has been observed going back to the Spanish scholastics in the 1400s. Copernicus made note that when you have more currency units pouring into the economy, prices have to rise, otherwise things will go off the shelf, right? Mm-hmm. I think supply chain would probably play a role in it, but make no mistake about it, when you expand the currency supply, prices inevitably have to rise. There has to be that equilibrium. Otherwise, things would just go off the shelf.
So it's a worthy debate, and we're having it. But I go back to just a little anecdote about the Depression. And what you say is true. The Depression ameliorated conditions, you know, from 25% official unemployment when Roosevelt took office to about 13% unemployment just before we got into World War II. I might also add that throughout the Harding and Coolidge and Hoover period before the stock market crash, unemployment remained steady at about 12% during that time. But with that said, it ameliorated conditions for millions of Americans, as did the Great Society. My anecdote is the great stage actor and movie and TV actor John Houseman was a young actor in the 1930s who was out of work and was starving, and went to work actually as an actor under the Works Progress Administration, one of the more famous and either most popular or most unpopular, according to some, of the New Deal programs. And he said, let me sum it up in one phrase. we were damned grateful to have the work and to be able to pay for it. And there's always the human element, I think, to be considered in all this. There are people who really need help. The help should come from a free market. With an enormous amount of wealth being created, we're not talking socialism here, but we're talking fairness. And the inequality of wealth is something that's been a tragic byproduct of sustained economic growth. And there are tens of millions of people missing out and losing out. What is the one factor then that can, I'm not going to say equalize, but at least allow or promote a fair shake, a fair share for people? And that's the federal government. And as far as the Biden presidency is concerned, he is taking the New Deal and the Great Society one step further. And the big battle he has, I think, is not simply the Republican Party. I think more important than that, his big battle, it will be with young people who do not trust the federal government to do anything good, or see it as actually a distrustful. And in that sense, then, I think the president took a risk. But his programs thus far, at least, taken one at a time, are very popular with majorities of the American people.
You know, I think one of the misconceptions of the free market is that the free market only benefits big business. I would argue that big business hates the free market. I mean, John D. Rockefeller himself was known as saying competition is a sin. What he really meant by that was competition against him was a sin because he wanted to corner the market. John D. Rockefeller wouldn't have thrived as much in a freer market. That's why he bought his way into legislation. A lot of the progressive movement was influenced by people like Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller. And there's a great book. I know you know the author. You turned me on to him, Gabriel Kokel, who wrote a book called The Triumph of Conservatism, which is a complete misnomer, right? Because this has nothing to do with liberal conservatism. It has to do with a corporate buyout of this country. The corporate powers and the state powers merging together in the progressive movement, ultimately benefiting the corporations and siphoning off the wealth from small and medium-sized businesses. So a free market, and look, there'll never be a pure free market. That's utopia. That's impossible. But a freer market stands to benefit small and medium-sized businesses, right? Because there's minimal barriers of entry into the marketplace to compete and sell goods and offer services. So we have this notion that today's wealth inequality was created by a free market. That's actually preposterous. If you look at the fat cats on Wall Street who are still collecting their millions and billions in bonuses, making millions and tens of millions in bonuses every year, they never lose those bonuses. Mm-hmm. Wall Street and the companies that build their wealth around Wall Street continue to get richer. That's not because of a freer market. That's because of a highly regulated economy led by the Federal Reserve that has policies which do not benefit the Main Street. I mean, look how much the Fed has intervened since 2008. They have done nothing but shortage of pure intervention into the market. And at the same time, you've seen Wall Street and the ancillary businesses that grow up around it get richer while Main Street gets poorer. That's not because of a free market. That's because of an interventionist government. So you can't conflate free market with interventionism. Interventionism always benefits the corporate powers because they oversee the legislation of the intervention.
So final words, just another anecdote. John D. Rockefeller, of course, the founder of Standard Oil Company, and in Pittsburgh. And one of the famous lines about him was that he did everything to the state legislature in Pennsylvania except refine it. The final note here, I'm going to give a grade, and I want you to, for Joe Biden, for the first 100 days. I'm going to give him an A, and I'm going to write my report card for the Washington Examiner a little bit later on and giving him, an A. What's your grade? And we'll close out the week.
Withdraw passing.
Withdraw passing. Okay, that was courageous. All right. Hey, I'll talk to you soon, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye. Have a good one.